From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! Is the Civil War still raging in the presidential campaign of Patrick Buchanan?
Really, since the war ended and the North has been writing most of our history books and our political science textbooks, we see the North in the white hat and the South in the black hat. It's just all negativism, and the Ken Burns series on the PBS network was more of that, the war just being over slavery and nothing else, blah, blah, blah. We're just a little weary of that, and I think Pat Buchanan shares that with us, if nothing else.
The Confederate flag flies high at the Southern Partisan, a journal where Pat Buchanan is a senior advisor, will talk to editors and critics of the magazine. Also, grassroots activists on today's primaries, the struggle for reproductive rights in North Dakota, gay rights and visibility in South Dakota, and immigrant rights in Arizona.
All of the candidates, whether they're Republicans or Democrats, have decided to use the border area as a major scapegoat for major problems that fester within the United States. It's so that most of us who live here along the border now essentially live in an area where the Constitution does not apply. All of us are subjected to being stopped just because of the color of our skin.
That and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. The front page of this week's Legal Times has an article headlined, Pat Buchanan, Rebel with a Cause. It says Buchanan is a senior advisor to Southern Partisan, a glossy magazine with a circulation of 15,000 that decries the Civil War as the war of Northern aggression, flirts with seceding as an option for the modern South, and defends the ethics of slavery. Joining us to talk about the Southern Partisan is its editor, Orrin Smith, speaking to us from South Carolina. We'll talk with historian Eric Foner, who wrote Reconstruction, America's Unfinished Revolution. But first, Smith will be joined by Boston University economist Glenn Lowry and Legal Times reporter Benjamin Witties. Ben, let's start with you. How did you find Southern Partisan?
Well, I was going through the magazine rack at Borders, and I ran into a magazine that was provocatively titled Southern Partisan, and I pulled it off the shelf and noticed, this was about 6 months ago, and I noticed that that Pat Buchanan's name was on the masthead, and that didn't make a particular impression on me until more recently, when his association with Larry Pratt, the head of Gun Owners of America, became something of an issue in the campaign, and I thought, you know, in the case of Southern Partisan, this isn't merely a question of whether or not the person might have ties to the Christian Identity movement or the militia movement, but might even, I mean, this is a magazine that, at least on its surface, seems to defend the decision to secede in the South, or very aggressively defends the decision to secede on the part of the South in 1861, and even seems to imply that making that decision again in 1996 wouldn't be such a crazy idea. And I thought that was a very interesting and somewhat ironic association for a presidential candidate of the United States of America.
Orrin Smith, you are the editor of Southern Partisan. How would you describe your magazine? Would you say Ben Witties has accurately described it?
Well, I don't think so. We've run articles with those who advocate Southern secession as a way of informing our readers about the wide range of opinion there is out there about various issues that affect the South. Michael Hill, the head of the Southern League, was the source of our what we call our partisan conversation a few issues back. And he has definitely provoked quite a controversy and a lot of discussion by heading up this organization called the Southern League. And not to interview him would be a real shame not to present that information to our readers, because he needs to be known and his ideas need to be debated, we think. But we've never taken a position in favor of a 20th century try again at the old Civil War.
Do you think it was a good idea at the time?
That the war was a good idea at the time?
Yes.
Well, it being our bloodiest war, where we lost more in that war than we have in all the rest of the wars combined, I don't think it was a very good idea. It should have been prevented and averted, but the southern side definitely needs to have its day and its say. What we've seen in the media, and really since the war ended, and the North has been writing most of our history books and our political science textbooks, we see the North in the white hat and the South in the black hat. It's just all negativism, and the Ken Burns series on the PBS network was more of that, the war just being over slavery and nothing else, blah, blah, blah. We're just a little weary of that, and I think Pat Buchanan shares that with us, if nothing else.
Ben Witties, your response to the fact that the Southern Partisan represents all different points of view?
Well, I'm don't mean to argue about that with the editor of the Journal. On the other hand, when you read, I've read cover to cover six issues of the Southern Partisan. When I read it, I don't the range of views covered by this magazine are range from nationalistic Southerners with very conservative politics to nationalistic Southerners who favor and defend secession. So I think that to say that it covers all views would be certainly a mischaracterization of the publication.
May I comment?
Let's bring Professor Glenn Lowry into this discussion again, professor of economics at Boston University, and formerly with the American Enterprise Institute. He left when they published Dinesh D'Souza's book, The End of Racism. In protest, he left. Yes, Professor Lowry.
Well, really, I left the AEI in a dispute with the president about the quality of that book. But in any case, what I want to say, listening to Mr. Smith, it strikes me there's something quite interesting here. Which is that the identity of the Southerner, of those of us Americans who identify with the South, with the Confederacy, with the culture and history and honor, and this is analogous to other identifiable groups of Americans, if you will, minority groups, cultural minorities, who are also making the same case that I thought I heard Mr. Smith make. That is a case that we don't get no respect, you know, that we didn't
right.
we don't control who writes the textbooks, we don't control who writes our history. And there's just something in my mind ironic and interesting about the fact that at that level, when one talks about a kind of cultural assertion, there's a very close similarity between what some of those who associate themselves with the Confederacy want to do for themselves and their culture, and what some racial and ethnic minorities want to do for themselves and their culture. And I just thought that was a point worth making.
Professor Lowry, do you take exception to the Southern Partisan's view of supporting secession, at least in 1861?
Well, you know, I don't share the view. There's no doubt the Civil War was a great tragedy. There's no doubt. On the other hand, slavery was also a great tragedy in my view, and I can't say as a descendant of slaves that I regret the fact that the war resulted in the emancipation and really in a reordering of the American governing institution so as to allow for citizenship and participation in the polity for people who had been held as chattel. On the other hand, I mean, I just know that there are people who have Mr. Smith's view in our republic. It is a free country. They're entitled to express their views, but they're not views that I share. And, you know, to the extent that they are views that would inform a presidential campaign and a presidential administration governing the country today, I would have some pause about that.
Well, speaking of presidential politics, Ben Witties, you brought to the attention your article to the campaign of Patrick Buchanan. Again, he is an advisor to this publication. They have run his column when he's not running for president. What was Patrick Buchanan's campaign's response?
Well, they issued a statement saying that Mr. Buchanan, who has been a subscriber and reader of the Southern Partisan for a number of years, considers it a high compliment to have been asked to serve as an honorary advisor to the magazine. That was a statement in the name of Terry Jeffrey, who's one of the senior campaign aides, one of the managers of the campaign. There's been no, they did not respond in sort of more detailed questions that I posed to them. At the same time, it's very consistent with Mr. Buchanan's past pattern in being confronted with associations which the mainstream press sort of regards as unusual, and he has stood by Larry Pratt, and he's stood by his association with Samuel Francis, despite a long discussion of that matter in the press.
Let's talk about Samuel Francis for a minute. Samuel Francis, who has written pieces that the Southern Partisan runs, a recent subject of a city paper here in Washington story. Mm-hmm. Who is Samuel Francis and what ran in Southern Partisan?
Well, Samuel Francis is a very conservative, sort of the paleoconservative variety columnist who used to be an editorial writer and columnist for the Washington Times and was actually fired from the Washington Times for being too right-wing, which is the Washington Times is sort of the conservative paper that it's pretty hard to do. The articles that the Southern Partisan ran by Samuel Francis were actually some of the articles that got him in the most trouble in the context of the Washington Times. And specifically, I think there are two that really caught my eye. One is the a column that he wrote criticizing the Southern Baptist Convention for apologizing for slavery. The argument that he makes is that the apology that they adopted is out of whack with their own history and their own literalist reading of the Bible. I'll quote two brief segments of it. If the sin is hatred or exploitation, they might be on solid ground, but neither slavery nor racism as an institution is a sin. Indeed, there are at least five clear passages in the letters of Paul that explicitly enjoin servants to obey their masters, and the Greek words for servants in the original text are identical to those for slaves. Neither Jesus nor the apostles nor the early church condemned slavery, despite countless opportunities to do so, and there is no indication that slavery is contrary to Christian ethics or that any serious theologian before modern times thought that it was. And then later he writes, "You can dismiss the New Testament passages about slaves obeying their masters as irrelevant today, but they happen to occur in the same places that enjoin other social responsibilities like children obeying their parents, wives respecting their husbands, and citizens obeying the law. If some passages are irrelevant, why should anyone pay attention to the others? And if you shouldn't, why not sign up with the feminists, the children's rights crusaders, and dare I suggest it, the Bolsheviks? So much for Christian family values."
Orrin Smith, you are editor of the Southern Partisan. Why did you run this piece? Did you agree with it?
Well, Sam Francis is a syndicated columnist, and I don't know how many newspapers he's in, but a lot of them. He's with the Tribune Media Service, which we subscribe to, and when they offered him as a possible columnist for us to run in the back of the magazine to replace Pat Buchanan when he started running for president, we accepted that, and any article that he has that has a Southern twist to it, we've generally run to provoke a debate. But like any other columnist in any other newspaper in the country, he's just a columnist that is syndicated, and we're not, he's not one of our editors. We do not adopt his views. If someone signs an article in the Southern Partisan and we have it on page 3 of our magazine, opinions expressed in signed articles do not necessarily reflect the views of the editor or publisher. Mr. Francis's views, Sam is probably the definition of a loose cannon in Washington. He makes Pat Buchanan look like a softy. He likes stirring the pot and stirring trouble, I guess we could say. And we thought it might be interesting to present that view to our subscribers and to see what we could get going on it.
And did you get any African-American response?
Well, no, we haven't so far. I expect we will, but we've gotten a lot of response reacted negatively to it, quoting scripture, stating positions of Christian theologians from Christian seminaries at the time of the war, both North and South, about slavery. That we've published and will continue to publish.
Let's get Professor Glenn Lowry back in this discussion, professor of economics at Boston University. Your response to Sam Francis.
What's the meaning of the reconciliation within the Southern Baptists, or a comparable kind of reconciliation within the Pentecostals? So in our contemporary social life, it's a kind of a statement that, look, we're one nation here. We're divided by race, to be sure, black and white, but we're one nation, and we should be moving towards some kind of larger reconciliation that allows us to transcend and to move ahead. And what I see as the potential danger of the kind of opinion that Mr. Francis was expressing was to sort of argue against that, to sort of say, look, there's nothing to be transcended. And I would feel the same way if a radical black who says slavery was evil, these people are evil, they'll never be able to be dealt with, they are, you know, by virtue of having, where their ancestors participated in this, beyond the pale, there's nothing to talk about. I would reject that too, and I would reject it on the grounds that if we're going to be, one nation in the 21st century, we have to move beyond history and find a way of relating to each other across this racial divide.
Let me ask Orrin Smith something. It is the question of Arthur Ashe and the controversy in Richmond over putting up his statue. What is the stance of Southern Partisan putting up his statue in line with the, I guess right now there are a bunch of Confederate leaders there?
Well, I don't think that we really have an editorial position on the Arthur Ashe statue. Of course, we, again, back to good old Sam. Sam Francis ran an article. We ran an article that he wrote about it, where he was trying to say that the whole issue represented a larger issue of whose myths were going to be followed, and that was certainly interesting, and we all can always count on him for that. But we really don't have a position one way or another. A lot of the citizens of Richmond, I'm sure, would like Monument Avenue to be preserved. So you've got a wide range. Some think that Monument Avenue should be preserved and Arthur Ashe should be put there. As a good sign of racial unity. Others think that it's racially divisive, that maybe Ashe should have a separate park dedicated to him and more of a focus on him. Some didn't like the statue. So there's just a lot of different opinions floating around on that one, and we've really never taken a stand.
When you say a separate park, sort of like a segregated park.
Well, no, I don't mean having the white Monument Avenue and the black Monument Avenue. I mean, maybe Arthur Ashe's descendants who are still here, family, wouldn't like to be on Monument Avenue. Maybe that would not be a good association for him and his opinion, his family's opinion.
So have you interviewed his wife?
No, we haven't. But we're not the Richmond Times Examiner. We don't focus just entirely on some of these narrow issues of certain locales. We only publish four times a year, and we only have about 50 pages per year. So we don't have as much space as we would like to devote to these issues. And
well, Professor Lowry, we only have a minute, and I want to give you the last word here, both on this debate and since this is an election show, and we're looking at Pat Buchanan as the advisor of Southern Partisan, and the piece that we are looking at today, Pat Buchanan, Rebel with a Cause. I wanted to end on the question of Pat Buchanan, his lifelong admiration of the Confederacy. Portraits of Robert E. Lee and Jefferson Davis hang in his study. In the last campaign, he visited the Mississippi gravesite of his slave-owning great-great-grandfather who fought for the Confederacy in the Civil War. Then as he paid his respects the following day at Beauvoir, Jefferson Davis's retirement estate. What do you feel the message Pat Buchanan is sending and this magazine is sending?
Yeah, well, I think it's appropriate in the context of a discussion about myths, because it seems to me what this the question you ask me really is about is how is it that the way one looks at history should be read as a signal of what one will do with our contemporary problems. I can see a person who admired the Confederacy, admired the culture and history of the South, notwithstanding the fact of slavery, nevertheless being an admirable, competent political candidate, someone in principle whom I might even be able to support. I can imagine that in theory. But the question would come as to whether or not that support of these artifacts of our an aspect of our American history was really kind of a signal, or if you will, coded a representation of certain harsh views about the place of African Americans within the contemporary American polity. And, you know, there's a kind of political correctness that you can put on this in which you can say, well, no one can admire Robert E. Lee, because if he does and Robert E. Lee fought for the Confederacy and the Confederacy defended slavery, then that person is indirectly defending slavery and therefore unfit to hold office. That, I think, is wrong. But if someone questions whether or not the dispensation issued in by the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments was itself an appropriate move for the federal government to make, or whether or not you know, Roger Taney in that Dred Scott decision was correct when he said that Jefferson's, you know, self-evident truths, all men created equal, did not apply to Africans. Well, that's a person who I think is unfit to govern in our contemporary polity. So that's the way that I would put it.
Dr. Glenn Lowry is a professor of economics at Boston University. Ben Witte is a reporter with Legal Times, and Orrin Smith, editor of Southern Partisan. We want to thank you all for joining us. We'll be back with historian Eric Foner. You're listening to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. We're now going to historian Eric Foner, author of Reconstruction, America's Unfinished Revolution. Dr. Foner, your response to this discussion of the Southern Partisan, for which Republican presidential candidate Pat Buchanan is a senior advisor.
I found the discussion very interesting. I've seen a number of issues of the Southern Partisan, although it doesn't circulate that widely in New York City, where I live. Mr. Smith sounds very reasonable and open-minded and quite, you know, well-balanced in his presentation of all points of view. But if you actually look at the Southern Partisan, which I'm sure most listeners have not, you will discover that it is an extremist publication which prints very, you know, really outrageous sorts of things, both about history and current politics. And whether or not he as editor is completely responsible for it, they certainly attract letters and articles from people whose views are quite different than what you heard. There are strongly homophobic pieces, letters or articles denouncing homosexuals. They've published things claiming that blacks are incapable of exercising democracy, or they published a letter by a fellow who visited New York City and said, well, I thought, where are the Americans? I only met Italian, Jews, and Puerto Ricans. In other words, this magazine is like turning over a rock, and a lot of strange things crawl out when you do that. Maybe this isn't the editorial policy of the editor, but it certainly seems to attract people with a lot of resentments, a lot of hatreds, and really who feel that the Southern heritage that is being protected or defended by the Southern Partisan is a very narrowly defined one. It's a Southern heritage of white, Christian, straight men, I guess you'd say. And anyone who doesn't fit those categories is not part of the Southern heritage. In fact, the thing that strikes me the most, both about the conversation and about the magazine, is that The Southern partisan speaks of the South over and over again, but blacks are not part of the South. The South, for them, are whites. Over and over, they talk about the Southern view on this, the Southern view on that. Even take the Civil War, secession. At the time of the Civil War, there were 9 million people living in the Confederate States. 4 million of them were blacks. Now, that's a fairly substantial part of the South. They didn't, those blacks, those slaves and free Negroes, did not hold the same views that Mr. Smith and his magazine are glorifying. They wanted the North to win the Civil War. They didn't see the Civil War as the beginning of a Leviathan state. They saw the Civil War as part of the process of emancipation from slavery. But their views don't count because they're black, and they're not part of the South as this definition of the Southern heritage goes. So really, beneath this fairly genteel and pleasant presentation, there is a very narrow, restricted, and very often quite bigoted rhetoric that is promoted by this magazine.
Now, this is an election show, Democracy Now!, and the reason we're taking a look at Southern Partisan is that Patrick Buchanan is the advisor to Southern Partisan. He has proudly said that when asked for comment in the Legal Times piece. His campaign manager, Terry Jeffrey, said, "Mr. Buchanan, who has been a subscriber and reader of the Southern Partisan for a number of years, considers it a high compliment to have been asked to serve as an honorary advisor to the magazine. What is your take, then, on Patrick Buchanan? I don't know if you needed this knowledge of him being the advisor
of
Southern Partisan to have an opinion.
I seen his name as one on their list. He's a senior advisor, according to the masthead. You know, playing the race card, which really was this amounts to, is nothing new in Republican politics. After all, in 1964, Goldwater voted against the Civil Rights Act of 1964, and his whole strategy in that election was to base himself upon the segregationist South. Reagan in 1980 or 84 began his presidential campaign by going to Mississippi, Philadelphia, Mississippi, where three civil rights workers had been murdered, and basically saying, look, forget about those three civil rights workers. I'm here to defend the white South. There is a significant vote of white segregationist or racist Southerners, and conservative Republicans have been going after that vote for a long time. So for Pat Buchanan to, you know, I don't think Pat Buchanan cares one way or the other about interpretations of the causes of the Civil War, but he's, you know, there's a bunch of votes out there, and he's trying to appeal to them. That's what politicians do. And as I say, conservative Republicans have been trying to appeal to this particular kind of vote for a long time. So in a certain sense, I don't see anything unusual about what Buchanan's doing in connecting himself. He's just a little more conservative, but that's true on many fronts.
It's interesting, as he campaigns through Arizona, one of his main points with English only, for example, and his anti-immigrant views is that we have to maintain one nation. He talks about the threat of, for example, what is happening with Quebec. And he talks about one nation. And yet this magazine is ultimately about secession.
Well, as the editor said, they have not, as far as I know, endorsed secession. On the other hand, if you go on the internet to the home page of the Southern League, which advocates secession, you will quickly find a link to Southern Partisan. So they're sympathetic to the idea of secession. Perhaps they haven't endorsed it. They certainly have published many articles. And certainly their view, as we've heard, about the Civil War is pretty much that the South was right, that Lincoln was a tyrant, that the emancipation of the slaves was really a mistake, and that the period after the Civil War, I'm a scholar of the Reconstruction period, and they have published the most retrograde things on that period, things which are 50 or 60 years out of date by the standards of historical scholarship, you know, arguing that blacks were completely unprepared for freedom, and it was a mistake to give them the right to vote, and they were all corrupt and ignorant and stupid. There isn't a reputable scholar in the country who holds that today, and in fact, what they published on Reconstruction was originally published in the 1920s, and they just reprinted because nobody today in the scholarly world holds those views.
Now, let me ask you something. A lot of people are saying that right and left is breaking down a bit. I mean, you have someone like Patrick Buchanan, who is the only candidate, Republican or Democrat, who's against NAFTA and GATT, which, of course, environmentalists and labor unions were very much against. Now, in this publication, in addition to criticizing you for your book on Reconstruction, saying that you weren't representing the Southern point of view, not, of course, considering the African-American point of view Southern. They also criticize you for your role in the Disney project, which I guess what, you were being paid by Disney for their project in the South that
yeah,
ultimately...
unfortunately, I wasn't being paid. I wish I had been. I was going to be an advisor to Disney if they ever built that thing near Manassas, and really I had nothing to do with it, and it eventually didn't, I mean, in the sense that it didn't happen, so I never gave them any advice. But, yeah, my feeling was that if they're going to build a historical theme park, historians ought to be there to help determine what kind of history it is. But their objection to me and to Disney was that I am, as one of their articles said, a Marxist-Leninist historian. I mean, they also go in for this McCarthyite thing. They attack my parents, my uncles, because of their political histories even before I was born. In other words, this was just a sort of scattershot approach. But they don't like me. But my main problem for them is my book on Reconstruction. They don't like the fact that my book on Reconstruction emphasizes the role of Black Americans in that period and sees the enfranchisement of Blacks and the empowerment of Blacks after the Civil War as a great triumph for American democracy, not as a terrible imposition by the North on the South, as they see it. They claim I'm anti-Southern. My book on Reconstruction won the prize from the Southern Historical Association in 1988 as the best book of the year on Southern history. The Southern Historical Association is not composed of radicals from the North. It's all these Southern historians. So their view of what is Southern or not is not only racially tinged, but is really completely out of date, even in terms of what it, you know, the people who are actually doing and teaching Southern history in the South nowadays.
Last question. It has to do with states' rights. A lot of the Republican rhetoric right now is about giving power back to the states. Now, many people understand states' rights in the context of slavery, for example, giving states those rights. Is that what states' rights is all about when a magazine like the Southern Partisan talks about it?
Well, yes. States' rights has a long history in the United States, and it has that has been supported by people in all parts of the country at one time or another. States' rights is generally upheld by people who don't like what the federal government is doing, and then they claim the rights of the states. But certainly in this context, states' rights was not only the great bulwark of slavery, but of segregation much more recently. The opposition to integration in the South was all couched in the language of states' rights. But we ought to remember why it was that the federal government became empowered in our history. It was because the states and local governments proved incapable of dealing effectively and justly with the problems that we had. If there had been pure recognition of states' rights, you still would have slavery in this country. You still would have segregation. It was the failure of the states to address these problems that eventually led to the federal government taking them on. And, you know, I would be very loath to see all this power go back to the states if the states were going to be governed by the point of view of the Southern Partisan.
Dr. Eric Foner is the DeWitt Clinton Professor of History at Columbia University. His seminal work on the post-Civil War period is called Reconstruction, America's Unfinished Revolution. And you're listening to Democracy Now!, Pacifica's national daily grassroots election show. We turn now to today's primary states, North and South Dakota and Arizona. In a few minutes, we'll be talking with the administrator of a women's health clinic in North Dakota. Did you know that no local doctors will perform abortions in North Dakota? That South Dakota is only the second state in the country to ban same-sex marriage? We'll talk with some activists in both states. But first, we turn to Arizona, where Pacifica National Affairs correspondent Larry Bensky is standing by. And he'll be joined by Guadalupe Castillo, a member of Derechos Humanos, a group that advocates for Latino and immigrant rights in Tucson, Arizona. Larry, welcome.
Thank you, Amy, and hello, Guadalupe Castillo. I'm in Phoenix. Guadalupe is in Tucson. And one of the issues that has been on the agenda here, although I must say it isn't addressed clearly or frankly, is the issue of immigration, Arizona being, of course, a border state, a state with an estimated 20% Latino population, and a state where unemployment is theoretically very low, and a lot of low-wage jobs are available, wage jobs that are traditionally filled by immigrant populations. Guadalupe Castillo, what is your impression of the immigration factor in the Republican primary so far?
Well, I think that the this factor is obviously playing well into certain sectors of the community here in Arizona. But I think for the vast majority of people from Arizona and the border regions, anti-immigrant simply translates to anti-Mexican, anti-Latino. And so the rhetoric is, to me, despairing. To have our diversity in this community, which includes not only Mexicanos, Latinos, African Americans, but certainly Native Americans compose a large a sector of our population, trample for a personal political gain.
Well, one of the most visible manifestations of that kind of rhetoric is coming, of course, from Pat Buchanan. And you can't turn on the television set here for 2 minutes, of course, without seeing tons of political ads from all candidates, most especially Steve Forbes, who's spending an estimated $3 million in this state. But Pat Buchanan is running ads, too, and one of those ads is an ad about immigration. I'd like to play that, the audio of that for our listeners now, and then get your reaction to it.
Each year, millions of illegal immigrants pour across our southern borders into the United States. Most come without job skills. Crime explodes. And who pays the cost of their health care, housing, welfare? You do. Thanks to one unelected federal judge. I'll term limit these federal judges, declare a time out on new immigration, secure America's borders, and insist on one language, English, for all Americans.
Now, the visuals that go along with that ad are of police arresting young Mexican-American men or Mexican men trying to come across the border. You've seen that ad, I assume, Guadalupe.
Yes, I have, and I consider that ad to be as pernicious as was the Willie Horton ads that were run in the last presidential election. Immigration for the for these candidates, especially Buchanan, they have made immigration the Willie Horton issue, emphasizing crime and welfare to our people, to the people of color. And I think that this is divisive, and beyond divisive, it is dangerous as well, because when he shows and talks about that our country is under foreign invasion and that we must stop this foreign invasion, I believe that this is dangerous because it calls upon the militias and other paramilitary groups that function along the border and other people to actually kill people coming across the border, to have the army at the border, which is already there. We're already highly militarized here along the border because of making the border sort of the lightning rod for all of the social, economic, and political ills of the United States. It's an easy area, an easy target, because we are fairly isolated. And so the consequences then remain here. But the consequences are harmful to our communities in the violation of human rights and literally living in communities that where the Constitution does not function.
We have to take a break in a minute, but I wanted to get your answer to a question that's being asked around the country in this 1996 election year. If, as you say, the community is isolated, can that isolation be broken to some extent by greater voter participation? Traditionally, in other states and here in Arizona, Latinos are underregistered and underrepresented at the voting booth. Is something going to be done about that in 1996?
I think that various groups have already have started and have for many years started to have people register to vote. And obviously that is an area that is of concern to all of us, is to get people out to vote. But I think beyond the vote, I think more important as well is to mobilize our communities. I think that what is going to turn this around is to have a social movement of people denouncing the atrocities that are being, announced by these candidates. And I say atrocities because there is real harm to people at the border as a result of this hot rhetoric, such as there was harm to African-American communities as a result of the Willie Horton ad.
Guadalupe Castillo, stay with us. We're going to come back after a brief pause here on Democracy Now! I'm Larry Bensky in Phoenix. Guadalupe Castillo is 2 hours down the road in Tucson. Today is the Arizona primary, and those of you who listen regularly to this program will hear us with results and analysis tomorrow morning. Meanwhile, stay with us. We'll be back in 60 seconds.
And you're listening to Democracy Now! Coming up in a few minutes, we're going up to the Dakotas, to North and South Dakota, to talk about women's health care, to talk in gay and lesbian rights. But right now, we're going to stick with this conversation in Arizona with Guadalupe Castillo, a member of Derechos Humanos, a group that advocates for Latino and immigrant rights in Tucson. And we're also with Larry Bensky, a Pacifica National Affairs correspondent who's in Phoenix. Guadalupe, I wanted to ask you about the other candidates. I mean, it is easy to isolate Pat Buchanan. After all, the Republican establishment is attempting to do that right now. But what about the other candidates and their views on immigration?
Well, I think that all the candidates, and I would even say the Democratic candidates as well, are giving out an anti-immigrant rhetoric. And I think that it is a scapegoating because the issues are not being addressed in their complexity. The issues of the movements of people across borders is a very complex one and is a long historical one. And I think that those complexities are not being addressed to the American people. And so rather than addressing the complexities of these issues, it is simply better just to use scapegoating simplistic rhetoric.
The way that Arizona's gerrymandered Guadalupe Castillo, Latinos have one member of Congress, Ed Pastor, who represents one of the districts along the border and part of the city you live in, Tucson. The other district along the border is represented by Congressman Colby, a Republican. And I saw him yesterday at the Tucson Women's Lunch, Women's Republican Lunch, where your group was picketing outside. Mm-hmm. And when I spoke to him and a couple of his aides afterwards, they were upset about Pat Buchanan's rhetoric. They thought it was very divisive. And several of the other Republican women in the room that I spoke to thought that Buchanan was divisive. And indeed, Buchanan got a very cold reception, relatively speaking, at that luncheon. Do you think that his popularity, Buchanan's, in Arizona may be overrated?
Well, I think that in certain areas of the state, it would be overrated. Certainly, if you notice what areas he visited, he did not visit Nogales. He did not visit Douglas. Because those communities are overwhelmingly in majority Mexican and Mexican American, and they would have come out truly against to show that his popularity is only, very strong in certain pockets of Arizona. He certainly did not approach the Native American groups that are here in Arizona, and some of whom are often. Voted as Republican, I think that there is absolutely his campaign was geared to those sectors that he could appeal to and that are very divisive. I think that Arizona has a large population also of militia groups and paramilitary groups and fringe groups, and I think those were the groups that he was appealing to.
Well, we should tell our listeners that it's a cold, clear day here in Arizona. It snowed overnight in the northern part of the state. Speculation about voter turnout is that it's going to be somewhere between 10% and 20% of Republicans, which is quite low, and that Bob Dole is in bad trouble here, and Pat Buchanan looks like he has momentum for him. That's the official wisdom anyway. But as you say, Guadalupe Castillo, a lot of Buchanan's support is from rural areas. Rural areas are less than 15% of the state now, which has become very heavily urbanized.
Well, we organized several protests here in Tucson in southern Arizona, and I can tell you that the protests were very diverse. We had people from all sectors of our community, from the gay, lesbian community, from the Jewish community, from the Native American community, from the African American community, so that from the Anglo community, so that I think that there was a message also given to Mr. Buchanan, is that Arizona, the vast majority of people of Arizona, not the people simply who are going to go vote today, but the vast majority of people in Arizona will not stand for his racist rhetoric.
Well, from Arizona, we're going to go now to North Dakota, I guess, and back to you, Amy.
Thank you very much, Larry Bensky, Pacifica's national affairs correspondent, and Guadalupe Castillo, a member of Derechos Humanos, a group that advocates for Latino and immigrant rights in Tucson, Arizona. I dare say they did not get much mainstream coverage of their protests. It seems to be a very studied approach that corporate TV is taking. Don't cover the issues, or at least not the people who are on the ground bringing them up. Well, here at Democracy Now!, that is what we're doing. That is our mission. I'm Amy Goodman, and it is now that we go to North and South Dakota to talk about some issues there. We're joined by two activists. In South Dakota, Barry Wick is with us of Free Americans Creating Equal Status, also known as FACES, a lesbian and gay rights group in Rapid City, South Dakota. The South Dakota Family Policy Council recently won a victory when the state legislature became the second state to pass a law rejecting gay marriage. Jane Bovard is also with us at the Fargo Women's Health Organization, the only abortion provider in the state, but it doesn't use local doctors. It flies doctors in from other states. Quite something. Let's start with Barry Wick in South Dakota. Tell us about the situation there.
Well, first of all, we're sort of recovering from the signing that the governor did. The governor refused to see a representative from the North and South Dakota ACLU and myself, Governor Bill Janklow, and so we were surprised by that, at least not having a chance to sit down and talk. But the focus, I understand, on this program is about the election today, of course, and it's my expectation that we're going to see a pretty tight race. But I do believe Buchanan may pull this out. In 1988. Pat Robertson won the state over George Bush, which was, my understanding, the only state that Pat Robertson did win. And so I'm very concerned that it's going to go very conservative today. Mm-hmm. We've had a situation here in Rapid City, of course, recently with the Rapid City Police Department refusing to make an arrest in a very well witnessed event, an attack on a gay man. And I don't know what to do at this particular point other than to write letters and to get other folks to take action in this area.
Mm-hmm. Tell us about how the same-sex marriage ban got passed.
Same-sex marriage ban came up last year in a form that literally was a ban in a bill called House Bill 1184. And remarkably last year, and I mean remarkably, we won in the Senate. It failed to be scheduled last year. Now this year, they came back with a little, what I would call, softer approach. The ban, if you will, really more or less added a definition of marriage to marriage law in South Dakota. Under House Bill 1143, it would just say that a marriage was between a man and a woman. And so that didn't have the same effect of wording, and it may not have the same effect in terms of an outright ban on same-sex marriage, because the state of South Dakota, it's still in the marriage law that South Dakota must recognize marriages from other states. So this may not affect the situation. However, we still put on a full court press. We won both committees. We won the House State Affairs Committee. and on a vote of 8-5, they tabled it. And then they did a procedure called a smoke out, and they smoked it out onto the floor of the House, where it passed 49-18. It went to the Senate committee. We won the Senate committee. They deferred it to the day after the legislature closed down, so they deferred it to the end. And then it by a vote of 4-2, and then the full Senate smoked out the bill back to the floor of the Senate. And they voted on it 26-8. And in the last couple days before the vote, our support just completely caved in. It was a blizzard of paper on the desks of all the senators in South Dakota from all over the United States, having been encouraged by Focus on the Family radio program to call all the senators in South Dakota and all the stuff that went on there. It was just an unbelievable thing.
Barry, just to explain to our listeners, when you talk about how there might be a way to get around this, because South Dakota still recognizes marriages from other states.
That's correct.
Now, Hawaii did pass, the first state in the country to allow single-sex marriage?
Well, the final decisions, the Supreme Court of the state of Hawaii ruled in a case, Bear versus Lewin, that the marriage laws in the state of Hawaii were unconstitutional. And so what's happened in this situation is that they're going through the final arguments sometime in the summer this year to make the final arguments. The Supreme Court threw it down to the lower court to make final arguments. And so it's likely that we're going to see same-sex marriage this year or perhaps next year in the state of Hawaii. And it has not been finally decided. Still, there are no same-sex marriages in Hawaii or any state. But all the states, there's up to 19 states now that are doing these preemptive strikes on the marriage issue that will be, they're trying to get it passed. There have been 3 states so far that have refused to even hear this kind of a thing. So.
Barry, let's go north for a minute to North Dakota, to Fargo, to Jane Bovard at the Fargo Women's Health Organization. Tell us about this very unusual clinic and this situation in North Dakota where you have some of the strictest anti-abortion laws in the country, yet you also have a pro-choice governor.
Well, our clinic has been open since 1981. At the time we first opened, there were 2 other physicians in the state who were providing abortion services. Those doctors have since retired, both of them are in their 70s, and we have ended up being the only clinic in North Dakota that provides abortion services. We're on the border of North Dakota and Minnesota, so we're on the very eastern edge of North Dakota, and we get patients, obviously, from all over the state of North Dakota, but also the whole northwest corner of Minnesota.
And what about the doctors who perform abortions at your clinic in Fargo?
First opened, we hoped that we would have a local doctor after a year or so who would work with us.
Jane, can you speak up a little? We're having a little trouble hearing you.
Okay. Can you hear me better?
Yes.
Okay. We thought that initially we might be able to have a local doctor who would work with us, but that has not happened. We have had to bring doctors in. One of our physicians has been with us since we opened. He flies his own private plane in from the northern part of Minnesota, and another one of our physicians flies in once a month from North Carolina, and we have been totally unable to get a local physician to provide services. Part of that has to do with the incredible harassment that we have had to live with over the years. We have been the focus of numerous national groups that have come to Fargo that have locked themselves inside the clinic, that have picketed my home and physician's home on a regular basis for at least 10 years. And I think the local physicians feel like, why should they bother? We're here. We'll do their work for them. And they can live a nice, pleasant life without being harassed and still send their patients to us.
What keeps you going?
Well, I think it's very obvious there's a need for our services. We see about 1,500 patients a year, and the patients that do see us are incredibly grateful, and it's particularly noticeable. We've had a terrible winter here, and we have worked, seen patients on 2 days when there were blizzards and everything in the whole state was closed down almost except us, and the strange thing is our patients show up for their appointments and will come through a blizzard or anything, and they are all so very grateful. They say over and over and over again, thank you, thank you, thank you for being open, for being here. And it's just very obvious that our service is greatly needed and that we provide something that people want and need. And for that reason, all of the staff feel gratified, and we feel like we really are doing something important and good.
Now, Jane, we've heard a lot about Pennsylvania and its very strict anti-abortion laws in Pennsylvania, but North Dakota we haven't heard much about. What are the restrictions on abortion, and how much time do you have to spend at the state legislature?
Well, the restriction, I think North Dakota probably has the most restrictive laws in sense of being most restrictive, but also as the number of them. We have had a parental consent law for years. We've had an informed consent law that we challenged after Pennsylvania, but went into effect. Our patients have to receive consent 24 hours in advance, plus their parents have to be notified 48 hours in advance of the abortion. We initially were not allowed to do abortions beyond 12 weeks in our clinic. They had to be done in the hospital. We challenged that law, and it was struck down as unconstitutional. We have just, we have a very, very strong right to life group in this state, which is spearheaded by the Catholic Church. And about 25% of the religious population in this state is Catholic. And so they seem to have these little organizing cells all over the state, and it is not a good state for people with moderate to liberal views to be able to organize in. And it's been difficult. I have been involved in the legislature since 1975, and last year was the first time in 20 years that I didn't have to go to the legislature to testify against an anti-abortion bill. And most of us feel that that's because we do have a governor who is basically pro-choice, and I think he pretty much said to the powers that be that work in the legislature, I don't want to have to deal with this. Don't let something get to my desk. And for the first time in at least 20 years, there was no abortion bill that ended up on the governor's desk this time.
How is it you have a pro-choice governor if you have such vocal anti-abortion sentiment in North Dakota?
Well, because I think most people in this state are pro-choice, and I don't think that abortion is a big issue for most people. The problem is the state is very rural. Fargo has about 60,000 to 70,000 people, and it's the largest city in the state. And in these small communities, people don't talk to each other about their personal lives. We see two people from the same town on one day, and they're absolutely mortified that anyone would ever see them at our facility. People don't talk about it, so most people don't know how other people feel because it's not an issue that they discuss very much. And yet when it comes time to vote, they pretty much, I think, vote their conscience. And most people here believe live and let live philosophy, and you know, they'll say, well, I don't know whether I'd have one or not, but I don't think that anybody else should tell somebody else what to do.
Jane, we have to wrap up, but I did want to get a final comment from your southern neighbor, Barry Wick, as you listen to what's going on up north. Barry?
Well, you know, a lot of what she said about North Dakota applies to South Dakota. Many of the folks that are gay in South Dakota are certainly you know, quiet about their lifestyles. They're hardworking. They're tax-paying citizens, and they live very private lives.
And they certainly wouldn't tell people in their neighborhood.
That's right.
That's right.
Well, we want to thank you both very much for joining us, shedding a little light that's not being shed by the rest of the media on what's going on in South and North Dakota. Barry Wick is with Free Americans Creating Equal Status, known as FACES, a lesbian and gay rights group in Rapid City, South Dakota. And Jane Bovard is the administrator at the Fargo Women's Health Organization. While the clinic is there in Fargo, the doctors who come in come from out of state. That's it for today's edition of Democracy Now! Tomorrow, Bernie Sanders, the founder of the Progressive Caucus. To get a copy of this or any other Pacifica National Radio program, contact the Pacifica Archives at 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. Our program is produced by Julie Drizin with assistance from Pat Greenfield. Our engineer is John O'Leary. To reach us on the internet, check out our website at http://www.pacifica.org or send email to democracy@pacifica.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Join me again tomorrow for another edition of Democracy Now!